thanks a lot, guys. WG2P. And I've backed off on the mic. Hopefully that's helped.
That has helped. And thank you, Warren, for bringing this to our attention. Fascinating stuff. You got it, Roy.
Indeed. It is a brave new world, and every day people are coming up with new things to do. Most of them they should, occasionally things they shouldn't, and we tend to talk about that as well. So I just want to thank everyone for being here, participating, and helping me do this. Again, just for reference, if you want to give me any kind of a topic or a question, or refute something I said, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the articles that I cite and the article that shows the radiation pattern for ARD multiples of half-wave dipoles, you'll find that on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. And thanks again, and over to Dick so he can let Paul do his space report.
You've got my curiosity. Sounds to me like you found a beautiful picture of a whole lot of cucumber-shaped-like objects that act as an antenna pattern that are aimed in various directions in space. You found a cucumber diagram, Roy? Go ahead.
Well, personally, I would call them multiple dumbbells, so kind of rotated in space with higher and lower amplitude. Unfortunately, it's a nice article. It's a nice basic review article. They only give a single slice through it. I was looking for a really nice shaded 3D modeling of it, and I might come up with it later on and post it as well. But at least it gives you the gist of if you were kind of looking down on a three-half or five-half wavelength dipole, what the radiation pattern would look like from just looking down from above.
Okay, I thank you. Paul, WS2N, you tend to watch almost everything that happens. I am guessing they might not have given live broadcast of the Chinese space station diving into the Pacific Ocean. I'll bet there's no movies of that. But you probably knew when it happened. WS2N, K2RIW. You got a poll.
Oh, okay. Well, if there's anything on that, that will come out later. Sometimes they send their, they'll send a high-flying jet with all kinds of optical equipment on board to visualize the reentry of something enormous like a space station. It was two modules, you know, the space station itself and what you would call China's version of a Progress resupply ship attached. It all came down in one shot. So, let me drop it. This is WS-20. And I saw Roy's picture of the three types of antennas with the, I don't know, it did look like petals, but I'll go with the petal thing. But I guess, yeah, cucumbers would be good. But the easiest one to look at was the dipole one, of course, and then after that got more complicated with the different wave antennas. And I did send to you, Roy, the picture of Spin Launch, the Spin Launch company, with the Spin Launch vehicle that this guy's developing. It's pretty much all you're going to see is that vehicle. You don't see the centrifugal contraption that he's building. And it sounds very dangerous. They say when they first do it, they're going to have the area completely evacuated. If this thing blows apart, it's definitely going to do some damage. Let me drop it. But I sent you this picture of it, and you know, a couple of little sentences involving that company. So I don't know if you want to post that, and then if you want to see it, you could always bring it up on your website or anybody else. This is the 50th year anniversary of landing on the moon, and that happened on Saturday. So we all know that story. We've covered the Apollo and Mercury programs here enormously over the years. but moving into the future, is there was a launch yesterday, which is really essentially the 50th anniversary of that landing, and this launch came out of Kazakhstan by Russia on a Soyuz rocket, and they launched one American, Andrew Morgan, and two other people, Luca Parmitano. It's the second ride for him to the space station. He comes out of Italy for the European Space Agency. And Luca, you might remember, I think back in 2013, he was the astronaut that was doing a spacewalk, and there was a lot of water that developed inside his spacesuit, which eventually so bad that it got in front of his eyes and temporarily made him blind. So they aborted that mission. Him and his partner at the time, Chris Hadfield, he's from Canada. They immediately went back into Quest. So this guy, you would think, well, that must have scared the wits out of him. Well, he's going back up again probably for another 6 months or so, along with Alexander Skorostov. He's a Russian commander for the Soyuz spacecraft. And they made it in almost record time, only four orbits, so 6.5 hours later, they docked with the space station. And as of, I guess, 8:30 or so, I didn't see it yet. It's here on the net, but it was supposed to open up the hatch to welcome the three on board. They'll meet up with Christina Koch, who's going to be spending almost a year up there. An American, Nick Haig, he's up there. He's the one he got like a second chance. Him and the Russian. That when they went up, Nick Haig was on board the Soyuz spacecraft that had to abort. You know, they were actually above the common line, and they needed to have an emergency and go back to Earth. They actually landed a couple hundred miles from where they took off in Kazakhstan. And him and the Russian went down, and they lived to fight another day. He came back almost a year later, and both NASA and Roscosmos gave them another shot, and they've been up there for, a month or two. And they'll be welcoming the crew that just launched yesterday. So, they made it up there in a record time, about 6.5 hours. You didn't have to spend much time in the tight Soyuz spacecraft. You know, if you ever see them launch, they're shoulder to shoulder. And then finally, when they do get to orbit, they go into the orbital module that's in front of them, which they have a lot more room, and they can move around pretty good. They could even take off their spacesuits and get ready to disembark and get back into the International Space Station. So that's the story on that. Now, if you're talking about Elon Musk, well, he's the one that owns SpaceX. They have a launch coming up this Wednesday. They're going to launch from a launch complex 40 in Cape Canaveral. They're launching not a crewed vehicle, not yet, but another cargo vehicle. Considered the 18th cargo vehicle to go to the space station by SpaceX over the years. And one of the important payloads on board is actually in the back of the Dragon spacecraft, what they call the trunk. It's called the IDA 3, IDA for International Docking Adapter, which will be grabbed by the robotic arm eventually to be installed on a pressure media adapter 2. We're dropping it. Rather, pressure mating adapter 3. There's already one up there attached to pressure mating adapter 2, and this will be the second one. what these adapters do. They're big. They're you know, maybe 60 inches in diameter. They weigh about 3,000-4,000 pounds. And they adapt to the pressure mating adapter. Pressure mating adapter was the off-centered, conical type of small module that was attached to the space station to allow docking of the space shuttle years ago. Well, they're still attached, but they needed to upgrade the adapter itself. They came up with an adapter to upgrade the docking system for all these modern vehicles that are going to eventually be coming up. You got Dragon, you've got Skyliner by Boeing, eventually Dream Chaser by SNC, Sierra Nevada Corporation. That will be eventually docking to the space station, allowing people to go through. Instead of the berthing process, which is a bolt-up setup, this is an autonomous deal where, the space vehicle can come up and just dock all by itself, just similar to what the Russians do. And you would, instantly almost be able to open up the door and go inside. If there's an emergency, you go back through the hatch and you could quickly exit the space station. Where the bolt-up system, you've got 16 different bolts that have to be unscrewed. It would take, an hour or two to separate from the space station. This thing could take actual minutes if there was a problem. So they need the international docking adapter to be attached, which eventually is done by an EVA. Robotic arm will hold it in position. The EVA will eventually fasten it to the pressure mating adapter at some point, maybe a month or so from now, they'll be doing that. So this is they call it EIDA 3, International Docking Adapter Number 3. EIDA 2 is installed, and what happened to EIDA 1? Well, EIDA 1 was supposed to be going up a couple of years ago on a SpaceX crew vehicle, just like this one. And it got about, 30 miles high, and then the whole spacecraft blew up. So they lost everything inside, including this valuable docking adapter built by Boeing. So NASA, was building a second one, and they continued to build that one. And that second one was eventually launched, put up a couple of years ago. And eventually, astronaut Rubin and Kelly was supposed to get involved. I think he did get involved with that too. And he's the guy that was up there for a year, and they successfully attached it. And then they had some spare parts and a few new parts, and they put together EIDA number 3, and that's this one. So hopefully, that'll get up there. And once you have that capability, you'll be able to have two crewed vehicles from the stage from NASA attached at the same time. Right now, if you did it, you'd have one that's up there now. It has been used only once so far, and it worked out perfectly. And that's when the crew vehicle from SpaceX went up there in March and successfully docked with the space station. So what happened is the crew vehicle eventually came, disengaged and came back and landed successfully in the Atlantic Ocean. And then Elon Musk was going to take this thing and eventually set it up for two more tests. He wanted to set it up for an abort test using Draco engines that are attached to the spaceship. And if that was successful, he was going to use it for an in-flight abort test, put it on a booster, and launch it into above the common line, and just near the common line, and then separate the crew vehicle at that point, just to see if it could get away from an exploding booster. Unfortunately, the first test of trying to launch the vehicle from a platform, they were testing it on a platform in Florida, and as they were testing it, the whole thing blew up. There was like nothing left of this. There were pieces all over. So they took this very successful crew vehicle that went up to the space station. Without a crew, by the way, it went up there. That was their first test, and they wanted to see if it was going to make it there and come back okay without a crew, and it did. But they figured, well, you know, we got it. Let's use this, and we'll test it out. And unfortunately, there was nothing left of it. They did figure out that recently, just last week, I was reading that SpaceX, along with NASA and some government agency that was also involved, making sure that this is all done right. They inspected everything, and they figured out that one of the check valves in the propulsion system literally blew up, you know, and then completely destroyed the vehicle. They use mono methyl hydrazine fuel, and they use nitrogen tetroxide, which, from what I understand, is the equivalent of laughing gas. They use that for the oxygen. When they mix together, they instantly ignite. So they use it for their thrusters. They have 16 thrusters aboard the Dragon, and then they use it for the Super Draco engine. The thrusters are called Dracos, and they have the Super Dracos. So they're the ones for the abort engine. When they light off, they're more powerful than, I think, over two times more powerful. About three times more powerful than what Alan Shepard took to suborbital space when he took off on his first flight. So very powerful system. And it's all what's inside the crew vehicle of the Dragon. So when these two things mix, they ignite. Well, they tested the thrusters, and that went okay. They're relatively low pressure system. And then when they went to test this, they mixed. They were going to mix it together. They never got that part. You know, they were just starting, and then the whole thing blew. What they figured out was to pressurize the system, and they have to pressurize it up to a couple thousand pounds when they use Super Draco to get that high. They have helium compressed inside that vehicle, and apparently some liquid helium. Some liquid nitrogen tetroxide got into the helium line, and, you know, maybe about a pound of it, they think, you know, stuck within the helium line. And then when they were going to test the thing, they said 100 microseconds, well, one-tenth of a second. So one-tenth of a second, this liquid slug, you know, at an extremely high speed, it hit this check valve, destroying the check valve. I mean, you know, you would wonder, how could that be? And that's very possible. Just like when you could have a liquid slug of water in a steam pipe, it could put down a big, you know, 2-foot diameter pipe, and if that slug is moving at a high speed and that hits that an elbow down at the end, it'll blow that elbow right out of the street. That's happened, you know, to Con Edison in New York. Well, it's the same thing, except on a smaller version. This little bit of liquid came down and slammed into this check valve. That created an ignition, and the whole thing blew. The good news is that now they know what the problem is. They know how to fix it. So their goal was eventually to launch a crew, you know, maybe 4 or 5 months from now. They were hoped the latest by like November or December. It probably will go until January, February now that they, you know, they had this explosion. But that's the problem Elon Musk has. You know, he does good, and then boom, you know, what could go wrong? And next thing you know, some big disaster. That, you know, the equivalent of two spaceships actually blowing, rockets, boosters blowing up, and he had many blow up as they came back and land on these drone ships out in the ocean. But he prevails. He gets, he, you know, next thing you know, he's still at it. He's, now I hear he's involved with medical stuff. Now, not that it'd be outside, he's building something called the Star Hopper down, and he's building two of them down in Florida and down in Texas. But before I tell you that story on how he's doing this, does anybody have a comment first? In anything I've spoken about before? Okay. Well, nevertheless, the Star Hopper is being built in Texas, a place called Boca Chica, Texas. And now he's building another one identical to it in Florida. And what the Star Hopper is, I've talked about this on the net before, it's a test vehicle. And the idea is to test this future vehicle that will eventually go to the moon and to Mars. And that's called the Starship. He can't just build the Starship and launch it. He's got to do some testing. So he's got a long way to go before he gets that far. So he needs to build this vehicle, and you know, because they use methane, you know, for fuel instead of kerosene, like they normally do, and he's using, of course, liquid oxygen. And there's a lot involved, including the new, brand new engines. He's got these Raptor engines, they call them. And, you know, he's not going to use the old style engines from the Falcon 9. He's got brand new engines, which are probably twice as powerful as the old ones. And he's testing it. He's testing one rocket so far. Put it into a Star Hopper down in Texas. And he had the whole contraption, you know, chained to the ground where it wasn't going to go anywhere. And lit off the rocket, went up a couple of inches, and came back down. He just wanted to see if that was going to work. This week he was supposed to see if he could unchain it and let it go. And he wants it to go up, move a few meters over, and come back down. He only wants it to go up around 20 meters, so 60-some-odd feet. And then he plans on landing it right away, and then eventually getting higher and higher each time. And this, this vehicle, this... They're testing the Starship. There's going to be eventually seven of these engines inside the second stage. And that whole second stage is going to sit on the first stage. And the first stage is a monstrous piece of equipment, probably 150 feet high, a little more. And that's going to have 31 engines attached to it. So 31 to launch, and then that'll separate. First engine will come back and land on a drone ship or even back in Florida, but most likely a drone ship. And then the second stage has these seven engines will launch and, you know, go into orbit. And he would send up another heavy, they call it a, you know, he calls it a heavy, so it's a identical vehicle, except instead of having people or anything in it, he's going to have fuel. He'll refuel the ship that's up there, you know, top the tanks off, and then this thing will be able to go anywhere, or, you know, off to Mars, or if he wants to. First flights, of course, he plans on sending to the moon. In fact, he plans on sending, one guy's already got his ticket, a fellow from Japan, and he wants to bring a half a dozen friends with him. So, not that funny anyway. Any comments or questions? Well, he decided he was going to test this a couple of days ago. And it, you know, the whole thing actually went on fire. There's a camera located about 5 miles away in South Padre Island. And, you know, constantly looking at that vehicle. But apparently when he tested, something went wrong, probably a leak. I don't think it was in the vehicle itself. I think it was probably a pad situation, but I'm still not sure yet. And this methane went all over. I mean, this thing looked like it pin went on, complete fire. I figured that was another total loss. But, methane all just burnt off real quick, I guess, and left this thing intact. Yeah, had some repairs to do, maybe on the vehicle, definitely on the launch pad. But now he's talking about maybe another week. He'll try to do what he wanted to do, to launch this thing up 60 feet and bring it back down. Eventually, he'll like to gain on that, up to, 5,000 meters or something, they said, or even higher. And then once he can perfect that, he'll be able to go ahead and actually build the Starship that he wants to build. He's building an identical setup of this Star Hopper, they call it, the test program, in Florida. So, he's got two different crews working on these vehicles. And that's the story of Elon Musk. By the way, another thing that he owns is Solar City. I've seen Solar City on Long Island. I even went to a mall about a year or so ago, and there was a booth set up, and this guy was from Solar City. It's Elon Musk's company. That's what he does. He makes solar panels, along with cars, rocket ships, Hyperloops, and now he's into medical brain surgery, I guess. This is WS2N for ID.
Give me a couple words, Paul, on his Hyperloop. If I understand correctly, that was the a tunnel that was going to be dug between, let's say, New York and Boston, and it's going to be evacuated, and you get into this car that goes at super high speeds. I presume this was a proposal that pair of towns have ever approved yet. Is that true, Paul? K2RIW?
Yeah, well, and the name of the game is this big contraption that's gonna dig through the ground. Roy said before, the boring tool. So he wants to improve on the existing boring tools. They have these massive boring tools, but they go through miles. I think the tunnel in Europe was done like that. They had two boring tools, one started at one end, one at the other end, and they had to meet perfectly, and they did, of course. And what was it, 20 miles? Well, he wants to do it here. So he dug one from, his headquarters is in Hawthorne, California. So he dug one underneath the building. You could take an elevator down, and when you're down there, there's this tunnel that goes, I think they said a half a mile or so. And he took his Tesla car on a ride, and it might have been on 60 Minutes. And I took the reporter up for a ride on his Hyperloop. So that's the idea of that. Be able to drive a car, and eventually, I guess he would not have cars. Maybe he would have a thing that's going to be being, pushed from one end to the other, pressure on one side of the vacuum on the other. That's the goal. He wanted to do it in, I think, from L.A. to Las Vegas or something. I guess he didn't get the approval yet. Back to you, Dick.
To get the approval to dig the tunnel to make this super vacuum subway system, I'm going to call it, possible, that's a impediment. That's going to slow him down. But now the concept, you're going to put human beings in this subway-like thing. Let's assume that the car is, I'm going to pick a number, 6 foot in diameter, and it's going to travel 300 miles. So you're going to have a 300-mile-long tunnel, 6 foot in diameter, that has a near-perfect vacuum. If there isn't a near-perfect vacuum in it, then you can't move the car very fast. So there's got to be a near-perfect vacuum, 300 miles, 6 foot diameter tunnel, not counting the room for the tracks and the wheels. I mean, you got to somehow keep the car centered in that tunnel. And when people are going to get in and out of the car, you have to have the equivalent of an airlock. So the thing has to dock with an airlock in the side of the tunnel at certain locations in order to load people on and off. And if you get anywhere along this 300-mile tunnel, 6-foot in diameter, 8-foot in diameter, if you get an air leak, the air starts running in, the car can't move very fast anymore. So to continuously vacuum pump, I mean, this is a little bit like the vacuum chamber you've got for the LIGO machine, 4 kilometers long. And boy, that's a heroic effort to get the air out of all of that volume. So he has to keep the air out of this volume. That's one of the very hard parts. I'm not convinced that this is a viable approach. On paper, it sounds good, but I don't think he's ever going to build one and sell the idea. But that's just an opinion. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
I agree. Well, I guess it's a blown-up pneumatic system. You know, you go to, they probably still have it someplace. You would go to a bank and, you know, you put your papers inside the cylinder, put the cylinder in, and off it goes. And, you know, eventually comes back to you. And of course, that was very popular in the city. They had thousands of these cylinders all over the place. So it's that kind of idea. You know, you pressurize on one side, try to keep the pressure down low on the other side, and the thing's going to travel through these tubes. Big sweeping elbows. You couldn't have tight elbows before. They were very big sweeping elbows. I don't know if you ever remember seeing those things, but they were all pneumatic, and I guess it's that except bigger. And now we're going to put people in there.
Okay, that tube, that pneumatic tube that you use at a bank, and sometimes the portions of the bank are across the street. That runs at atmospheric pressure. And you're vacuuming out the air from a small diameter tube, and you're moving that shuttle inside at some relatively slow speed. If he's not going to operate these tunnels at a vacuum, if he's going to have normal air pressure air, and he's going to be sucking the air out of one end, and he wants to move these cars at near the speed of sound, I believe, in order to really make the travel time better than it would be with an aircraft. So he's moving a diameter of air, 8 feet in diameter, at near the speed of sound. That means you need the equivalent of a very large jet engine at one end or the other or both ends in order to move the air, in order to move your shuttle car. Wow. And you can only have one car in there at a time. And the safety measures require that you don't ram the car at some high velocity at the end before catching it, if you know what I mean. So if he's going to run that air pressure, he's got to have a huge jet engine pushing the air through it. Is that what you believe he was thinking of doing, Roy? Paul, WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, I remember reading his plans. That was a couple of years, time to go by. That was a couple of years ago. But he showed his tunnel off, I guess that was about a year ago, 60 minutes. But he just drove his car through there. Maybe that's his plan. You know, and it was a bit sized. I mean, this thing was, I don't know, it looked like a 10-foot tunnel to me. It's pretty big. And he drove his car right through it. So maybe that's his goal. Forget about the tubes, and we'll just take his Tesla car through it. I mean, I guess you could. It's an electric car. It's not like you're going to die from, carbon monoxide. But, yeah, that was something that would take billions and maybe trillions of dollars, I think, to try to do. Like you said, you're going to put one car on at a time. You know, that's not profitable. You've got to be able to move, hundreds and thousands of people at one time. Look at Amtrak, what do they get up to? Maybe 80, 90 miles an hour. I don't know if they go any higher than that. Although it looks like Japan and China are doing better. They got it up to over 200. France, for some reason they're doing better than we are. You got to make the track stable. In this case, you got to make those tunnels real stable. I think you got a long wait to see. I think we're going to see people on Mars before we see the Hyperloop built. Somebody building a 5-mile test track, I think, in Las Vegas, though. I don't think it's him. I think somebody else is doing it. Back to you, Dick.
Now, if the car was moving by maglev, so it really is a linear magnetic motor moving the car, that can give you some pretty nice propulsion, and pretty clean and quiet and whatever and smooth. That's the good news. And now, if the tunnel is going to be large enough that the car pushes the air out of the way as it moves, that's a possibility. Up till now, I was thinking that the whole tunnel operates at a vacuum. And boy, that's a very difficult... There's a zillion square... It's a zillion square feet of tunnel. You know, the area of the tunnel that all has to have perfect air sealing and vacuum pumps going all the time. That doesn't sound practical. If it's not... If the car is not going to push the air out of the way as the car moves, similar to a current subway... In fact, how does it differ from a current subway? If the car is going to fill up the tunnel and you're going to move that whole column of air, picture starting the car up. The car is sitting still, you just loaded on the people, it's 300 miles long, and now you want to accelerate a 300-mile column of air. And air is very heavy. You know how much force it takes to each cubic meter of air at normal standard temperature and pressure is 2.7 pounds. And so 300 miles of it is a zillion pounds. It's going to take a zillion horsepower to accelerate that air, that column of air. And once you've accelerated, you've got to stop it again. There are details here that don't sound right to me. The numbers don't come out nice, round, and convenient sounding. Which one of those ways do you think it is? Is the car going to push the air out of the way, in which case it's just an ordinary subway? If it's going to move a 300 mile long column of air, it's going to take ridiculous pressure and horsepower to do it. And if the tunnel is going to be a hard vacuum, to maintain that vacuum is very difficult. If you were the design engineer and you were choosing a technique, which of those techniques, and maybe none of the above, would you choose, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I remember seeing the Hyperloop when he first came out with it, but I don't think he had that many details on how it was going to be, how he was going to deal with the, I believe it was going to be all maglev system, though. I think that rings a bell. He was going to use that, which means he's going to have to push the air. Well, the good thing is, you know, the air has to be going somewhere if he's pushing it, and if he does get enough horsepower, to push all that air, you know, it has to be going somewhere. So to stop this thing, all you have to do is forget about the magnets. All you have to do is like close valves somewhere, you know, vents, and you know, build up pressure in front of this thing to eventually slow it down. So I don't know. My answer is I don't know. I don't know if he had final designs. In fact, I know he didn't have any final designs when it came out. Probably 4 or 5 years ago.
I could evaluate the total mass of a 6 or an 8 foot diameter circular tube filled with air that's say 300 miles long. The mass of that air is some number of trillions of pounds. That's trillions of pounds of mass that you want to move. Wow. So as I see it, this thing can only move at a high speed if it's in a vacuum, or if it's willing to be aerodynamically shaped and push the air out of the way as it moves, in which case it's just an ordinary subway, it's a maglev subway. There he almost stands a chance. But still, as he moves at close to the speed of sound, he's got the same problem of the fast aeroplanes. Can't even think of the name of the damn thing now. The airplane that flies at 3 times the speed of sound. And,
like the Concorde or the one of them, Blackbird?
Yeah, the Blackbird is what I'm trying to think of. And the surface temperature of that thing gets to the temperatures that almost make the steel or the titanium glow red. So you're dissipating tremendous amounts of energy by the heating of the air that's impacting the vehicle. If you move at the speeds that he would like to move to get people from point A to point B in a reasonable length of time. If he's not getting them there, getting from point A to point B, his passengers, in a short length of time, then they're not going to be interested. The price of a trip, you have to get something in return. Concorde was extremely expensive just to get there a couple hours earlier. If that wasn't being subsidized, it would never be able to finance itself. Over to you, Roy. Roy. There we go. Paul, WS2N, KQIW.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. I remember the Concorde. I actually saw it going overhead, and I saw it in the airport itself over at Kennedy. Very cool thing. It's going to work out. Well, NASA's working on it, and a couple of other companies are working on it. You know, maybe 5-10 years from now, you might see some kind of supersonic transport, but small, not carrying 100 some odd passengers. You know, probably some rich billionaire be able to have one of these things, maybe take 10, 20, 30 people with them. I think you might see that. Well, whatever. Oh, one other launch I wanted to mention is coming up in a couple of hours. It's about 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:13 tomorrow morning. Hopefully India will be able to get the Chandrayaan launch off the ground. Chandrayaan is the one I talked about, I think, last week and a week before. That is going to be going to the moon. It's going to take probably a couple of months to get to a point where it's going to land. I believe September, beginning of September, I think they plan on landing. You know, you're going to go into orbit, and each time you go around around the Earth, each, you know, very elliptical. Before you know it, that extends. You know, you keep extending that until eventually you get to quarter of a million miles away, and you'll get caught up in the lunar well into a polar orbit. They want to land down at near the South Pole, which nobody's able to do yet. So that's their goal. So, I mean, India has done this before. About 10 years ago, they launched a vehicle into lunar orbit. This one's going to have three components to it. The first one is going to actually be one that's going to be left in lunar orbit. On top of it, they've got this lander with the four legs sticking out that's going to separate from the orbiter, and it's going to head down to the lunar surface. And hopefully this one makes it, not like the last one by Israel. Got close, but then crashed into the surface probably about 400, 500 miles an hour. This one will try to do the same thing. It's going to land near the South Pole, and then after it lands, it's got a rover. The door's going to open up, and a rover's going to come out, and this one only has four wheels, four-wheeler rover. And we'll see how India does. They can join the lunar landing party, I guess you call it. Back to you, Dick.
So India's spacecraft is going to go to the South Pole, launch a rover with four wheels, and is the rover then going to move around and do so throughout a whole lunar month to prove that the temperature at the South Pole is more stable than it is at the equator? That's question number one. And question number two, Paul, is that the Vice President of the United States, in the last couple of weeks, went to a NASA facility and basically commanded them in the next 5 years to get men on the moon and to get them there, and I presume they're going to stay there for a while. And I presume the current thinking is they're going to go to the South Pole. Okay. Did NASA really believe the Vice President? Have they really shifted enough of their resources to this project so that in the next 5 years, by the year of 2024, Americans or any other nationality, men are going to go to the moon, to the South Pole, and stay there for a while, the beginning of colonization, so to speak, and they're going to get there with the resources where they got solar cells operating and habitats established. You see evidence that NASA has really committed to what the Vice President appears to be asking for? WS2N, K2RIW, great ball.
Yeah, well, they're going to have the Gateway space station up there as well. First of all, yeah, India launch this thing tomorrow. They have their own rockets. They have a big rocket and a little rocket that they use. The little rocket is for polar orbits, called the polar launch vehicle. And this one is the geosynchronous launch vehicle, the bigger one. And they'll be plus it's bigger than a normal geosynchronous rocket. Usually they used to have liquid fuel boosters, strap-on boosters. Now they have solid fuel boosters. It's going to give them a lot more power to launch this setup to the moon. Good luck to India. I'll know tomorrow, I guess. I'm not going to stay up to 5:00 in the morning, but I'll know tomorrow morning whether or not they got off the ground safely anyway. And then in September, we'll talk about them landing. And as far as us going to the moon, let me drop it. I think everything you said is true, except for the timeline. You know, all that will eventually come to pass. You got to go back to the George Bush administration, and they were pushing for the moon. They had the Constellation program all figured out. They were going to have this lander, and it was going to go down and bring four people to the surface of the moon. No space station whatsoever. Then along came the Obama administration, and they said, you know what, we've been to the moon before, we're going right to Mars. That's it. You know, everything was geared up for that. And the one thing that Obama's administration did is they straightened out this whole space launch system that they're going to use. Bush administration, they were going to have the Antares system, essentially. Not as good as, you know, it didn't work out for a long explanation. I'm not going to go through that, but their system didn't work out. Obama changed a very similar setup under his administration, but they stuck with that, and that's what they were building now, the space launch system. They were building it to go to Mars. You know, they missed massive, you know, 360-foot structure, almost the size of the Saturn V, much more powerful than the Saturn V, instead of 7.5 million pounds of thrust. This thing's going to have, you know, 8.5, and that's only the start. They'll start at 8.5, and then there's plans for bigger boosters, eventually working themselves up to 10 million pounds of thrust. All to go to Mars. Well, along comes another administration. Here we go. No, we can't go to Mars. Cross that off the list. That's where they wanted to go. That's the problem with NASA. Every 4 years or so, or sometimes every 8 years, they change their mind. No, we're going back to the moon. All right, so they're going to direct all their energy to the moon. NASA really wanted to do the moon by 2024, 2030. 2028 or 2030. That was their goal anyway, you know, even with the Mars program. So now all of a sudden, oh no, we got to do it by 2024. Sounds good until you realize that then I get 10 cents more to do it. They need more money for operating costs for the International Space Station. That costs $4 billion a year just to supply that. They only have a $20 billion budget. All these other plans, the other things that they've got going, you know, that money's gone. They need, you know, a lot more, billions and billions of dollars more than that. And meanwhile, they're not allocating anything. So you got more of a chance of maybe SpaceX making it to the moon or orbiting the moon at least before the decade is out. Let's put it that way, like Kennedy said. NASA, if they got money, but it doesn't look like they're getting any kind of money, then maybe they could do it. They got the Gateway system.
By the way, Paul, when we go back to the moon, we've only got a minute left, when we go back to the moon this time, I hope it's not going to be just a hop onto the moon for a couple of hours or a day and then come back home again, so to speak, or back up to the space station around the moon. This trip to the moon, is it going to be like colonization? Are they going to go there and stay for a while? That's probably the last question you can answer, Paul, if we run out of time. Over to you, Paul, KGRIW.
Yes, that's the goal. Go down to Shackleton Crater, dig up the ice, and, you know, and you can do anything you want with ice, turn it to water, rocket fuel, breathing, whatever you want to do. But yeah, that's the goal, except the money's not there for it. I don't see that happening, unfortunately. But that's it, you know, that's the long-term plan. And no way. Unfortunately. Unless they get the money. You know, you never know. Back to you, Dick. I know we're running out of time. This is WS2N. This has been the SpaceNet report for the Tech Net. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to take a look tomorrow and see how the Indian launch took place for their vehicle that's going to the moon. Good stuff, Paul. And Roy, do you want to repeat your addresses? And funny that I couldn't think of the SR-71 earlier. I'm getting senile. AC2GS for any final comments. KQIW. Thank you, Roy, and back to you, Roy.
Yes, thank you very much, Dick. Once again, if you have any topics, if you have any questions, if you refute something or argue something, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@alphacharlie2gulfsierra.com. And links to a bunch of things that I talked about and little article on the multiple lobes of a multiple of half wavelength dipoles. If you cut it in sections, so you flatten it to two dimensions, it does look like a petal. But unfortunately, since it's a three-dimensional object, it's a little bit more like a dumbbell. Anyway, that you can find at roy.ac2gs.com. And I've been looking and looking and looking for a better image, so I think I'm going to break out the antenna simulating software and once again do it myself, and if I do, I will post it for others to see.
That's a pretty difficult three-dimensional drawing problem. I looked at the website you presented on your site, Roy, and that's quite good. And don't put a lot of effort into that. Thank you very much. Bye-bye, you guys. We'll be back next week. There'll be more space. There'll be more puzzles. There'll be more discussions about Elon Musk and his craziness. Bye-bye, you all. KQIW clear.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Good morning, the time is 5:00 a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
K82 NVZ Mobile.
Station calling, this is K82 AMZ Mobile. Don't know how long I'm going to have you, but good morning. Name is Mike.
How are you, Mike, on this fine morning?
Oh, I'm very well. Driving down Northern Boulevard, heading into Huntington. And as soon as I hit Huntington, I will be losing you.
Gotcha. I'm on the expressway right now, passing exit 64.
Well, copy that. Well, like I said, I'm going to be losing you any second now. I'm heading down into the valley, so I'm going to sign. K2AMZ, I will be clear. Have a good one. Enjoy the day.
DU, 73s.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
This is K2RLW, Hackensack, New Jersey, listening.
That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
WB2ZSC. J2KMB, WB2ZSC.
Morning, Steve, K2KMB.
Oh, howdy. What's going on?
Not much. Not much. Just trying to catch up on some things. What about yourself?
Nothing going too bad. Just getting swamped again, apparently. Anyway, made it well into Queens, and I even had a stop over in Mineola for a second to check. Taking grab something I needed for later.
All right.